And we really looked at Jacksonville and said, well, it's actually an amazing city to grow a business because it's the cost of living is very, very reasonable. It's very true to your own adventure. Our employees really can, you know, in every stage of life, have a great time.
That was Andrew Rush, CEO of Made in Space. Andrew is our guest for episode 14 of Innovate Jax, the podcast where we hear the stories of the creators, innovators, and entrepreneurs who will help elevate Jacksonville as a leading southeastern city of innovation. I'm your host, Kate Warnock. Now, on to the interview. Andrew, we are so excited to have you back. You're our 14th guest for Innovate Jax, but more importantly, you are our first guest that we're going to be speaking to since the start of the public health crisis. So hopefully we can hear how Made in Space has helped. You know, I read that you did some real good here on Earth, and I really want to hear about that. But let's open up first with, you know, talking about Made in Space. What is this company? Can you give us, give us the elevator speech here?
Thanks for having me today. So Made in Space is an in-space manufacturing company really founded on the core desire, the core vision to enable people to sustainably live and work in space. This is not an unusual vision for folks in the aerospace industry and, you know, increasingly folks around the world. But in looking at that very, very early on, we said, okay, well, what are the barriers to getting to space and staying there and living there? And it turns out that the barrier that exists there is actually an economic barrier, that, you know, the way that we open up frontiers historically has been because there's an economic motivator to go to the new place, right? People went west, not because California's beautiful, even though it is. They went west because there's gold in the rivers that they could pick up and take back home and trade for profits and a life of luxury. And we really need to have that kind of driver for space. And we need to have the tools that enable us to utilize space in a more efficient way. So Made in Space is focused on in-space manufacturing because in-space manufacturing lets us utilize space in a way that generates products and, you know, processing of goods that, you know, have economic value back on the Earth. And it's a way that we can enable human exploration and settlement of space in a more efficient and cost-effective way. And it's also a way that we can make satellites in a more cost-effective and capable way than the traditional sort of origami fold them up and stuff them in a rocket and shoot them into space way.
The name of your company is very descriptive, Made in Space, but let's talk about the technology. What is it that you actually do and how do you do it?
Yeah, so we have kind of three main thrust areas. The first is manufacturing of satellites in space. The second is what we call space-enabled manufacturing. And the third is supporting human exploration. So in that first area, the satellite manufacturing, we have developed a series of technologies, robotic manufacturing and assembly technologies, to manufacture like large solar arrays, antennas, like the big dangly bits of satellites on orbit from, you know, just kind of raw 3D printer feedstock and like piece parts. So as an example, our first mission is called Arconaut 1, and Arconaut 1 will launch with a robotic arm and a 3D printer that can make things larger than itself. And it will actually, when it gets on orbit, it will manufacture large supporting structures that will be connected to rolled up solar arrays that will extend those out, providing much larger surface area for collecting solar energy than, you know, than any satellite in kind of size class that Arconaut 1 is has ever done before, which means we can provide a lot more power, which means we can use more powerful electronics, more powerful sensors to do missions for a wide variety of customers. The second area that I mentioned is space-enabled manufacturing. So this is taking materials and goods to space and processing them in microgravity. And because we process them there, they have interesting qualities. As an example, we've built an optical fiber production machine that makes this optical fiber called Z-Blan that has a transmission window that's much wider than traditional like silica optical fiber that you find in like Verizon Fios or whatever. And it has a signal loss that's much, much better. All that translates into more data. And we in this modern society, what do we always want? We want more data. So it turns out that you can only make Z-Blan really effectively in a microgravity environment. If you make it on the ground, it all these little crystals form in it and it doesn't achieve the performance that it theoretically can achieve. So we've just started kind of demonstrating the proof of potential of Z-Blan, and we have several other initiatives that are driving that direction. But that really we see as the as this amazing core of the future of low Earth orbit commercialization, the future of expanding the human economy into space and expanding industry into space, which ultimately, you know, once you have factories in a place, you know, a factory town builds around that, and then, you know, more and more, you know, civilization expands. So we really think that's this amazing thrust area. And then, of course, the third area I mentioned is supporting human exploration of space. And that's developing manufacturing technologies that work in the microgravity environment so that astronauts and other folks can respond more readily to issues that arise, can respond more readily to scientific endeavor opportunities, you know, by 3D printing tools, by 3D printing fixes up there on orbit.
I got to go to this amazing program that you hosted first quarter of this year. And I remember you sharing a story, or perhaps it was one of your colleagues, that you had just installed a 3D printer on the space station, I believe it was. And one of the astronauts who had been living there needed a wrench. And he was able to produce exactly the size wrench that he needed to perform this task, which otherwise he would have either had to do without, improvise with something else, or wait for it to be delivered from Earth. Here it is on demand. All you needed to do was upload the file for him to then print what he needed. So it really does speak to the future of what's possible. You know, as you were describing those three core areas of focus for your company, is Made in Space partnering with other people, companies that are helping to design, you know, these amazing big satellites? Is your team also designing that, or are you more the manufacturing of what needs to be created in space?
Yeah, you know, we like to say space is a team sport. There are lots of different folks on our team that contribute to all these different projects, and we have great partners on every single project we have. Great partners in NASA, great partners in DARPA, great partners in like large aerospace companies like Boeing and Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, and also great partners in more sort of non-traditional space users. So as an example, on that Zeeblan project I mentioned, we're working really, really closely with a company called Thor Labs and Dr. Mohammed Saad, which Dr. Saad's like one of the leading experts in developing and manufacturing these exotic optical glasses. So we work with these experts that see the promise here and have some really like interesting knowledge. And we partner with them to develop these products, develop these services, develop missions for customers, and then deliver those together.
So you're constantly learning, which must be so exciting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. So in talking about, you know, this manufacture in low Earth orbit or wherever you might be, do you predict that the technology that you're using in space will affect, change, evolve how we manufacture here on Earth?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've actually seen versions of that already. We developed the 3D printer first to work on the International Space Station. The way that we developed the 3D printer was on these airplanes that fly these little parabolas. They're commonly known as the vomit comets because they fly, they give you like 20 seconds of zero G, and then they slam you down and give you like two Gs and then go back and forth. And it's a little bit upsetting for the stomach. We ended up making a printer that could work throughout that whole cycle, which meant that not only could the printer work in space, it could also work, you know, just sitting on a table here on Earth. It also work like on, you know, on like a submarine or on a boat at sea that's like being jostled around. And we've seen that demonstration drive interest in kind of extreme environment manufacturing for deployed military bases, you know, naval vessels at sea, to have these kinds of manufacturing technologies to, in the much the same way that having a local real-time manufacturing facility helps astronauts in space, because it's, you know, really just shortening the supply chain. That same approach applies to a naval vessel, you know, out in the middle of the Pacific.
So take this from the layman that I am, you know, for this to work in such a remote region, doesn't it still require that internet connectivity?
So there's a set of instructions that you provide to the machine. And those instructions actually, it's only like a few megabytes for like your typical print, and it's like G code. So you don't need an internet connection. If you just say, hey, here's the file, go, then it's okay.
Oh, God. Okay. All right. So you really literally could be wherever.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Not dependent on that. Right. So as you were describing all these different partners, you know, space is a team sport. You have public and you've got private corporations in there. But I'm wondering, in your opinion, do you think that the race for space and the way that we're going to go farther in outer space, is it going to be driven more, in your opinion, by the private sector than by the government?
Where we are today, space will be driven by both commercial and the public sector. And really, traditionally, this has been the case for something like 30 years or more. The commercial sector has utilized big giant satellites in space to do like DirecTV and to do Sirius XM and a lot of the sort of telecommunications that we rely on. We just don't see it. And that's been going on for a very, very long time. We're seeing amazing leaps and bounds from the partnerships of the private sector and the public sector with NASA these days, especially with the launch of DM2 with SpaceX. Like, that's just truly, truly amazing. And NASA will always be a driver in the space industry, as will the DoD. I think what we're seeing, though, is you're seeing NASA and the DoD become very, very comfortable with saying, we're not going to design the rocket. We're not going to design the satellite. We're just going to say, we need stuff on the moon, or we need stuff in low Earth orbit, or we need pictures of this thing over there, like 12 times a day. And then going, and then the private sector saying, raising their hand and saying, hey, I can give that, I can deliver that to you, you know, and here's my price. So it's becoming a much more like commercial, higher pace of innovation, you know, sector compared to where it was maybe 25 years ago.
You don't see the paradigm flipping where the commercial interest dictates what happens in space versus government?
I think that the government is always going to be a trusted and valuable customer of virtually every space company. Space companies that, you know, reject the government as a customer often don't survive. Space companies that rely solely on the government as a customer find their opportunities constrained. So, and that way, I think there will always be this really, this like positive feedback loop between us as the private sector and the government as a powerful customer with enduring needs. Mm-hmm. And so it's our privilege to say, hey, like, we came up with this cool idea and it might be useful to you, you know, and then for our, you know, various government customers and commercial customers to say, that's awesome, let's go do it. Or, yeah, that's kind of sci-fi, I'm not really interested in that today.
Right, right. Okay. And not to put you on the spot, I know that you obviously have a very, you know, an amazing relationship with the public sector. It's more, I'm just curious, you know, as we, you know, you see the movies and Sir Richard Branson has been talking about space for 30 or 40 years, however it's been, you know, if it would just kind of change the nature of what we aspire to do in space, if it was more commercially directed versus not. Yeah.
No, I absolutely. And I think that this is the most interesting time to be in the space industry since Apollo. And I believe that it's going to be that way for the next 20 years because of exactly what you're talking about, because of the commercial sector saying, hey, we have these really good ideas and there's the wind at our backs in terms of finding a great rhythm with our public sector customers and with our public sector partners to drive things forward. People have been talking about economically reusable launch vehicles since before there were rockets that actually went to space. And we live in that era now. People have been talking about satellites that do manufacturing in space, again, since before we could put satellites in space. And we're on the threshold of doing that now. It's really an amazing time to be in this community.
All right. So I was in grade school, I think, when Hubble was first launched, and they realized that the mirror, that there was an optical issue that prevented it from being exactly what they hoped it would be. And so didn't they have to do a correction in space, or did they fly up a new lens or a new mirror or whatever it was?
So they've done several Hubble servicing missions. Mm. So they... And some of those, they would put, I think they called them bifocals. I think that was the joke.
Right.
They put some corrective lenses in Hubble. Right. And that was actually a really amazing technical achievement, but also a very dangerous mission. Actually, some of my friends were some of the astronauts that got in EVA suits, flew the shuttle up to Hubble, got out there, opened up Hubble, and like put new sensors on it, put the bifocals on it, upgraded the solar arrays, all these sorts of things. And it's amazing. It's amazing that we did that, and the science and the inspiration that Hubble has been able to share with the world, you know, it demonstrates the value of that. But if we can, we'd like to not put astronauts in harm's way like that. If we can, we'd like to optimize our satellites for the operational environment that they're going to work in, not just design them to survive launch.
Right.
And that's part of the promise of doing in-space manufacturing and assembly.
Right, right. That's so exciting. So, you know, talking about the wind in your sails and you know, we have all these amazing new things ahead. Can you give us some ideas of the projects that Made in Space has, you know, for the next 3 to 5 years, and what are you most excited about?
Yeah. So as I mentioned a little bit earlier, you know, probably the biggest project we have going on right now that we're very, very excited about is this satellite project called Archonaut 1. So a satellite that's going to literally manufacture and assemble itself on orbit. It's this tiny, like relatively tiny satellite that's going to fly up like kind of as a ride along on a SpaceX launch to space. And then when it gets there, it's going to robotically do manufacturing and do assembly. It's going to have a space capable robot arm and all this really cool stuff on it. And that's going to definitively demonstrate the value and the power of this technology. And I really view that as that mission, that program is already kind of driving this almost like Cambrian explosion of, you know, new approaches to satellite design and enabling us to provide more capability. Missions that we couldn't do before are now like very, very possible. So over the next like 3 to 5 years, I'm really, really excited to see how many satellites we put up with this technology, how many satellites we start designing with this technology, just how we can provide more capability for customers ultimately. Because really, even just from a power production perspective, we're going to be able to provide the power that you'd normally only get on a satellite that would cost like $500 million for like $100 million. So significant savings, significant increase in capability for our customers. And especially in kind of the times that we live in where budgets are very, very uncertain, being able to provide more capability in a more economic and a more responsive way is really, really crucial.
Right. Well, Andrew, I want our audience to have a better understanding of your company background. And I know that your team, you've already mentioned you had a base out in California. Mm-hmm. That was, Silicon Valley was really where you launched. But you've moved your headquarters here to Jacksonville. So help us understand, why did you start there? It's pretty obvious. There's lots of opportunity there. But what brought you here?
Maiden Space was founded on the NASA Ames campus in Silicon Valley. It's a really, really great place. And it's a great incubator for us. But as we grew, we really said, okay, we're a company that builds very expensive hardware that takes kind of a long time to put together relative to an app. And this is like the most expensive zip code in the country. So maybe that's not the best place to like build a rocket factory and start building these rockets or start building these satellites rather. And we had a presence here in Jacksonville and really just looked at Jacksonville and looked at the then existing partnership that we had with folks like Space Florida, which has a great relationship with the Office of the Governor and, the kind of the very forward-leaning way that they were saying, hey, we want to attract and retain, aerospace companies, aerospace talent in the state, because that's historically been this franchise, honestly, of the state of Florida. And we really looked at Jacksonville and said, well, it's actually an amazing city to grow a business because it's the cost of living is very, very reasonable. It's very choose-your-own-adventure. Like our employees really can in every stage of life, have a great time, right? If you're young and you want that sort of hip urban experience, like Riverside's great. If you're like myself and you have, a couple of children, there's a wide variety of great educational opportunities. If you love the beach, you can live at the beach. If you love the woods, you can live in the country. If you love the river, you can live on the river, all for the price of less than, a 4-bedroom townhouse in Mountain View, California. That was a big motivator, but it's also a big motivator that Jacksonville is a really substantially sized city with a lot of really great talent. We've been able to hire a lot of local folks to work high technology jobs just straight up locally. We've been very, very pleased by that. And local university systems as well have been very, very engaging with us, which has been really nice.
So, Andrew, I'm glad that it's a perfect lead into my question. I just read an article on Forbes by Sachin Jain, who was saying that, people like to... they kind of focus in on their IP as the most valuable thing in their company. And he said, no, it's your people. And so here you said that you were able to hire locally. Undoubtedly, you brought, some phenomenal talent from California. But what are the skill sets that you're specifically looking for Maiden Space? What's the right kind of mix in your employees?
Yeah, so space is, unsurprisingly, like any industry, is a mix of really all disciplines. So from an engineering perspective, obviously, we're a very heavy engineering organization. Mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, systems engineers, aerospace engineers, roboticists, material scientists, software, electrical, just really runs the entire gamut. That group of engineers doing amazing work, designing these satellites, they need support and they need their talents and their voices and their capabilities magnified so that we can have the impact that we want to have on the world. So we have business development professionals, we have communication specialists, we have business operations and finance and accounting, just a whole wide variety of folks, and me,
Are you creating patented technology? And so I imagine there's that entire legal aspect of your company as well.
Yeah, my background is in physics and the law. I like to joke that I'm a recovering lawyer. So we have a pretty wide patent portfolio that before I was CEO of the company, I was primarily responsible for curating. And now we work with some really fine folks to do that and to keep that portfolio driving forward, because the people are the core of our business. Without that great team that I was just describing, we would be nothing. We would just be some ideas, some ideas on PowerPoint. But the folks take those things and turn them into real things. And that's what we really take pride in, is going from saying, hey, here's an interesting idea, and then here's actually how we did it. Here's like the world's first manufacturing in space. Here's the world's first manufacturing of a space-enabled product. Here's a world's first satellite that's manufacturing in space, and just on and on and on.
Right.
And that's driven by the team. But of course, intellectual property is part of protecting the brilliance that team is generating.
Right. You mentioned just a moment ago talking about working with the local universities, and you've had great collaboration and you're finding the talent that you need. Do you think that it makes sense, should curriculum in today's society be incorporating more at the grade school, high school level, that focus on space, so that we really are gearing ourselves towards where we ultimately might go?
Curriculum from K through 12 and on, having more of an emphasis on space is really useful, so folks can be thinking about that and understanding this new frontier. But more broadly, a focus on things like robotics and just next generation technologies, not only from the engineering perspective, but just from the kind of philosophical and the applications perspective, I think also is very, very important. STEM is really, really important, and it's great to emphasize those things. But it's also, I think, important to tell folks, like I was talking about a little bit earlier, that all these areas, all these high technology areas, and space included, need all kinds of folks to be successful. So it's not just the engineers. If you want to be involved in space, if you're a 6-year-old little girl and you want to be involved in space, becoming an engineer absolutely is a way to do that. Becoming a great communication specialist, also a great way of doing that. Becoming a great business analyst, also a great way to get involved in space. It's really, what do you want to do with your career, with your time? What do you want your legacy to be? And finding a commonality between that and the skills that, and the inclinations and the things that excite you.
That's so exciting. It makes me think of that Jodie Foster movie from years ago where she was an astronaut. She was a scientist sent into deep space, and she saw the new world, and she said they should have sent a poet, not an astronaut. So you really speak to that, which is really exciting. I'd love to think that it's not just the STEM folks who would benefit from the next frontier. It's, pretty much anybody who has a passion.
Yeah, absolutely.
So getting back to yourself, you mentioned that you were a physics major. You actually graduated here from UNF, and then you got your JD from Stetson. What brought you into the space field?
So I think I was raised by my parents on a pretty steady diet of science fact and science fiction. I grew up here in Jacksonville. We watched the launches on a regular basis. My mother's a physics and chemistry teacher. My dad's a chemical engineer. So this is probably pretty much the direction my life was going to go based on all of that.
You couldn't escape it, right? Yeah. Oh, wow. That's awesome. They must be so proud of you. And are they still here in Jacksonville?
They are, yep.
Oh my gosh. They get to see their son build his company. That's really cool. So let's close out. You as CEO, you mentioned that you came into this role. You first were, kind of protecting all of the IP that was being developed. And now you moved into the CEO position. Why don't you share with our audience some of the biggest challenges you've had to overcome? And then we can end with what you would consider your biggest win.
That's a good question. Being a CEO is really interesting because, especially when the company's small, there's two real things. You're basically the chief doer. If there's not a person to do the thing, you're the thing either doesn't get done or you're the person that does it. And there's also can be this fascinating and frustrating disconnect between things going really well on the one side and things having significant challenges on the other hand. And that can happen simultaneously. That can happen. The morning can go great and the afternoon can be not great, or vice versa. It's a constant roller coaster. But I'm incredibly proud of the team that we have been able to build and how they have overcome those challenges. Made in Space 5 years ago was, a dozen folks. Now we're 120. Mm-hmm. And that's an incredible amount of growth. And you can't accomplish that unless you find folks that have a commonality of vision and are willing to lean in and willing to work hard together. and, you know, willing to kind of recognize that roller coaster and say, hey, we're going to ride that roller coaster with you. The success that we've had as a company is really, I'm fortunate to be the person here with UK talking about these things, but it's really because of the efforts and the successes and the drive of, you know, the other 119 people that we have.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, are you hiring?
Yes, absolutely.
That's awesome. Okay. And tell us, where can folks find out more information about your company and about the positions that you might have available?
Yeah. We're hiring right now for a wide variety of engineering positions and as well as non-engineering positions, as I was talking about a little bit earlier. Our website is madeinspace.us, and there's a careers link there. It's just madeinspace.us/careers. You can go and check the website out and tell them you heard the podcast, and we'll talk to you.
You know what? And one final question, you know, in the midst of COVID and the fact that folks have had to work remotely, has that impacted how your team operates?
We've been very, very fortunate to not only have customers that have been very supportive in the midst of this global pandemic, but also, you know, that have leaned in with us and have even started new projects with us over the last couple of months. We have switched to a primarily work from home configuration. So kind of at the leading edge of the pandemic, we told all the engineers, we'll take your computers home, take all your equipment home, you know, so you can do design analysis from home. If you need to come into the facility to do flight builds, testing, all those sorts of things, you know, we have a structure in place for you to do that, you know, protects you. We have PPE for you, you know, just to, again, to focus on the health of our staff, but also focus on the health of our company, because maintaining operational capacity of the company helps our employees, like helps us all be successful and work together. We've had some efficiency drops, but the team's really rallied and, you know, leaned in with one another. We've gotten really, really good at video conferencing.
So yes.
That's been nice.
Unfortunately, we all have, isn't it? Just a challenge for sure, but if anybody can do it. Well, Andrew Rush, this has been such a great conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Innovate Jax. For show notes and a list of all our episodes, go to Verqura.com/InnovateJax. Know a Jacksonville changemaker who'd make a great podcast guest? We want to hear from you. Message us at InnovateJax@Verqura.com. Thanks for listening.